Welcome back to the show. It is Thursday, September the 28th. I am Eddie Lindenstein. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. And welcome back. I can't remember if I... Did I talk about COVID last week? Had COVID for the second time. Kind of sucks. But it was the world's shortest lived bout of COVID ever. And I felt great. I felt 100% within 4 days or so. 3 or 4 days. Maybe even like 2.5 days. But this week, which by the way, if you want to support the show, check out the Mind and Fitness Podcast on Patreon. That's patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast. I am off to coach soccer practice. And also, I get roped into, or asked, I shouldn't say roped. I got asked to become the fundraising chair for the local elementary school for the PTA. So the first meeting is tonight. So adding another thing to the plate. To do. So, but I wanted to take you guys back to January 16th of 2019. This is with Michelle Hintzberger, and this still remains, this is episode 53. This episode remains as the most listened to show to this day. Michelle's from Thunder Bay, Ontario in Canada, and her story was incredible. It was sad. It was heartbreaking at times, but how she explained how she's been able to get through her various mind-body issues over the years was inspiring. It was amazing. So I'm looking forward to everybody hearing this. So check this out. This is Michelle Hintzberger and I from 4 years, 8 months, and 12 days ago. So without further ado, here's Michelle and I.
This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein, and I am here with Michelle calling out of Thunder Bay, Ontario. Michelle, are you on the line?
I'm here.
Thanks so much for joining me. I a lot of times in when I do an episode, I always throw out a challenge. Hey, if you've got a great story to tell, I'd love to hear from you. And I heard from you via an Instagram comment, and you had offered up to you know generously share your story with the listeners. I feel like it's a mixed bag of people either really like interviews with the experts, the people that treat this stuff, but it seems like human interest is much more where it's at. So thank you for being willing to.
Yeah, I'm actually very looking forward to this interview and kind of helping spread the word about TMS and mind-body, the mind-body connection and just how in a way, how wonderful of a journey this has been for me. So
now, it's not like you're in the deepest, darkest trenches of Canada. When people think of Canada, they think of like the North Pole, but that's not at all where you're located. But I always do get, I like getting a perspective. Like I've interviewed people in the UK, I've interviewed people in Australia, and it seems like at different parts of the world, this acceptance, or at least the prevalence of like, you know, mind-body connection, mind-body medicine stuff is all over the board. So what is it like in Canada? Just general consensus. Would you say that it's, you know, popular and well-known and well-accepted, or is it the opposite?
I'd say it's pretty well the opposite. Okay. Definitely still very heavily what the doctor says is true society and looking to kind of cure ourselves outside of ourselves. That's still very prevalent here.
Yeah. Nicole Sachs calls it she says it's a take a pill society. It's in a lot of ways what it is. So, let's kick this story off. I guess like, you know, the thing that certainly caught my eye, you had a sentence where you said you basically like, you've got quite a story to tell. So let's maybe just get some background on you. I mean, if you don't mind sharing things like age and where you grew up and that kind of stuff, that's always a good starting place.
Yeah, so I've been born and raised in Thunder Bay, so I've been here my whole life. My mom, when I was about 3 years old, lost her hearing or began to lose her hearing. So I grew up with a deaf mother who eventually became very ill. Now I look at it, knowing what I know now, she had a body-mind affliction. But of course, back then in the 80s, it wasn't even close to being what it is now, what people know. So I grew up with a mom who was both losing her hearing, both also getting very ill. And with that, she lost a lot of her self-confidence, which unfortunately put a lot of stress on her and my father's relationship. And my brother and I were, we had a wonderful childhood, honestly. Like, we basically got kind of our basic needs met. We had a loving home, but there was a lot of stress between my parents because of what my mom was going through, just how they were dealing with it together. So I grew up in a pretty angry household, I would say. And so throughout my childhood, I had lots of stomach aches and headaches, and that was my first dabbling with TMS symptoms. Going into my teenage years, my mother and father decided to split, and it was a pretty volatile split. My brother and I were put in the middle quite often. I don't want to say not intentionally to hurt us, but they just didn't know otherwise.
Right.
My father actually left my mother for his mistress, so that was tough to deal with. And then about in my early 20s, this is when things started going pretty, it seemed like one thing after another after another. I mean, divorce is pretty common now and all that kind of stuff, but in my early 20s, I had a couple relationships that weren't fulfilling and whatever. I had the fallout with that. And then around 22, I got into a relationship with a man who ended up becoming my husband. But literally from the beginning of that relationship, just things started happening within my life. So my brother all of a sudden started acting very strangely, pretty much out of the blue. We always knew he had anxiety. And then he was diagnosed with schizophrenia within a few months of him starting to act irrationally. He went missing quite a bit. In the dead cold of winter, there would be weeks where we wouldn't talk to him, and it would be minus 40 degrees wow. at night with the wind chill. So that was a very, very scary time. My uncle got diagnosed with cancer. My childhood, we call it a farm, so it was kind of like a childhood home in a way. It was in my family for 100 years that burned down. My other uncle almost died in that fire, and then he relapsed with bipolar disorder and went missing. And then my grandma developed dementia really badly, to the point that myself and my mother had to take care of her at home. My mom got diagnosed with an early stage of cancer. Luckily, that was dealt with quickly. And then all the meanwhile, I was starting up my own business doing nails and overworking myself. So within about 7 years, it was just stress after stress after stress after stress. And I remember being at the dentist and I was grinding my teeth. My jaw was sore. And the dentist asked me, "Are you stressed out?" And I said, "No, I'm not stressed out." Meanwhile, like, I was so oblivious to how my body was actually feeling because I was living in my head so much, just trying to logically get through all of these stressors that had happened within the last 7 years of my life, basically.
So here's something that is coming to mind, and it's a discussion I feel like I have with a lot of people who will send, like, I'll get DMs and such, and people will say that they, you know, I didn't have a traumatic childhood. I, you know, I had a pretty good childhood. I had a sibling. I had, you know, my parents were around me. They loved me. How do I have this? And this conversation is going to be perfect for somebody like that, because, you know, earlier on you had described that for the most part, like, you had a pretty happy childhood. It was stuff that was going on later to which probably was the genesis of a lot of your own physical problems. You had the stomach aches and things like that, but there's all these different things. The, you know, the brother diagnosed schizophrenia, disappearing, the family farm burning down, the uncle going missing, the advanced dementia. Like, these are things that a lot of us, I think, that they deal with, and it almost like it like fragments over time, right? Like, me as a little kid, the equivalent of perhaps your mother's hearing going, you know, for me, it could have been my dad having a couple of hip replacements, my mom having arthritis or rheumatoid arthritis, and you know, then later on in life, like my grandfather dies, and then my brother and I are estranged, right? So I think a lot of people will try and relate back to these big key events when they were little kids, but you're saying that didn't really exist. It was kind of all this stuff in your 20s, right?
Right. I think that my mom losing her hearing when I was so little, and like I knew I was quite angry over that now looking back. Like I never felt heard, obviously. As a little kid, you're yelling at your mom to try and hear you. I think that just predisposed me to feeling unsafe as a child, yep. which then led into how I dealt with stress as an adult. And I literally was, and I read this in Steve Zanich's book. I believe it was his book where he talks about how you're just like a head with a body and there's like no connection there at all. Like I was so in my head that I didn't even realize like what was going on in my body.
Yep.
Like warning me like, you know, like danger, danger.
Yep.
Until it the tipping point and I developed severe pain.
So at this point you're in mid 20s ish, like approximately what year are we talking about?
So 2016 is when my symptoms got to the point that I couldn't ignore them anymore.
Hey, me too. How about that? We got that in common. okay. So that's good to know for context. Okay. So, you start your own business, kind of all the stuff is going on in the family. Then what?
So it would have been end of summer 2016. My boyfriend at the time and I bought a house, and the next day I started to develop pelvic pain. And I'd had this pelvic pain before at random times, often when I would go on vacation, which is funny looking back. But this time it just came out of nowhere. Like I was like, what is this? And I had it before and just kind of ignored it and it went away. But this time it started to scare me and I was like, I need to get this looked at. And so I had tests done and nothing came back positive. They didn't know what was going on. And then the pelvic pain would go away and I would get a burning tongue or a tight chest. And then that would go away and the pelvic pain would come back and then that would go away and I'd get back pain, but it would always come back to this pelvic pain. And that's what scared me the most.
The burning tongue. So I had never heard of this until a couple of months ago and somebody asked it of, I did like a Q&A episode with Nicole Sachs and she, somebody asked about burning mouth and then she told this story about a burning mouth for her. Did you go and see a doctor about that? And they actually, you know, quote unquote, diagnosed you with the reason that your tongue is on fire. Like to me, that would scare the hell out of me. Right.
Yeah, actually I remember working and thinking maybe I had developed like an allergy to the dust or whatever that I was working in that environment so much doing nails. So I actually went to Emerge because I also had like a very hard time having like getting a deep breath. So I went to Emerge thinking I was having like an allergy attack and, they did some tests and ran an EKG and checked my tongue. And the doctor said, everything is fine. It's probably just an allergy, but we don't know. And then it went away and it never came back. Like the burning tongue only happened a few times, but it was really strange.
Yep. Yeah. You know, I was thinking last night about, I got told by a chiropractor once, I don't even remember the exact context, but I had asked, like, I'm like, you know, what is the deal? Like, I'm like, I'll get ankle pain and then I'll get knee pain and then I'll get elbow pain and then I'll get shoulder pain. Like that they never exist two at a time, but for some reason I get this traveling pain. And he had told me that there was something like the reasoning for that is that, like the brain can interpret pain signals from more than one place. And I just sort of accepted it for the time being. But, mm-hmm. you know, years later, I'm looking back and I'm saying, no, that's not true. Because, like, when I go and lift weights, like, and I'm super sore the next couple of days, you know, like, I feel it in way more than one place. So that certainly never made sense to me. Okay, so you have the traveling pains.
Yes, big time. But then it basically settled mostly in the pelvic pain because that scared me the most as a woman, like, thinking, oh my God, am I not going to be able to have kids? Like, do I have, I don't know, cervical cancer or uterine cancer? And then my boyfriend and I were renovating our house, and I was overworking, and I was taking care of my grandma. And then around Christmas time when we moved in together, that's when it got terrible. So Christmas 2016 was horrible. My grandma actually passed away on Christmas Day, and I almost didn't make it to her funeral because I was in so much pain.
And this is 2016?
Yes. Okay. And looking back, it's obvious that it flared up so much with my grandma passing away, right? Like, obvious mind-body connection there. And then going into 2017, we still weren't sure what was going on. So there was a specialist appointment made. And sometime in January, I don't remember the exact date, but I followed a girl on Instagram who had chronic pelvic pain. And she was talking about the mind-body connection. And I kind of messaged her saying, what is this? What's this all about? And she added me to a group on Facebook for chronic pelvic pain using the mind-body connection. And right away, reading about it, and there's an interview by the Pain Psychology Center with her on it. And I knew right away that's what I had. So I'm grateful that I found out it was a mind-body illness pretty early into my journey. But then I was thrust into the fact that I need to take responsibility for this. So that was very overwhelming. And that there's really nothing a doctor can do about this pain. And I was in a lot of pain.
Yeah.
To the point where, like, it was hard to sit. I had to take 3 months off of work because I was in so much pain. So yeah, there was so many conflicting emotions, like, great, I know what this is. I know that there's something I can do about it. But how the hell do I go about doing this?
Right.
And so then I read Sarno's books, and again, they just reinforced, yeah, this is definitely what I have. And then it was just a journey of almost getting to the point where I was healed. And then I had massive panic attacks. So this would have been about 3 months into knowing that it was a mind-body syndrome. And I had never had panic attacks in my life, so I did not know how to handle that at all. And I was thrust right back into severe pain and panic attacks on top of it. And then throughout the next few months, I got addicted to the TMS forums. So spending, which I think is a pretty common thing, but not helpful when you actually are trying to heal. It's not helpful to be on those things all the time.
Yep.
So I got addicted to those and just got deeper and deeper into, like, this TMS on top of TMS on top of TMS. And I don't even know how it clicked for me. I think Sarno talks a lot about anger, and I definitely had anger, but for me, it was fear. So in the fight or flight or freeze part of us, for me, fear was what I had to deal with the most and had to come to terms with.
Do you think that it was the fear of, like, I'm going to be debilitated because I have this pain, or fear of something else?
On the surface, it was fear because of being debilitated because of this pain. But underneath it all, and what actually caused my TMS symptoms, it was the fear of not being enough, the fear of uncertainty in my life, the fear of, why was I overworking? Well, because I couldn't say no. I couldn't put boundaries up because I was so afraid that people would be offended. The fear of, losing my relationship, the fear of, I was always socially anxious growing up as well. Like, just, I felt like I didn't fit in often. So I think there is that, like, first layer where you're afraid of the symptoms getting out of control and not being able to do anything with them or cure them. But underneath it, at a core level, and what TMS is really all about, is that fear of not being enough. The inability to actually truly love myself was what I had to learn in order to actually fully cure, quote unquote, my symptoms.
What? So you had said that you essentially that this the connection for pun intended. I was trying to figure out any other word but connection to say. But which of Sarno's books, I guess, resonated with you the most? Like, where did that aha come from?
Healing Back Pain, for okay. sure.
Yeah.
It was more or less reading the success stories at the end.
Yeah.
And also when he was talking about that whole, how a lot of people have their symptoms disappear when they're on vacation. And ironically, I had in the previous few years symptoms appear while I was on vacation. So I thought that was a strange coincidence. And just how he talks about like the perfectionist characteristics of people who develop TMS. Like, I've always known I've been like that. I've always known I've been a people pleaser. So when he was describing the person who typically develops TMS, it was me to a T.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, like, and we'll probably dive a little bit deeper into this, but just some of the stuff that we've talked about so far, especially the part about the volatile split of the parents, right? To me, how I would interpret, like, my parents are still together. However, if I were a teenager and they had split, I could certainly see instances where I'm sort of, if I please everybody around me, then I sort of become invisible and I won't be a part, you know, I'm not a part of the problem. I think, like, kids that have parents that split up, I just think that there's an implication to themselves that they may have contributed to, you know, whatever the split was about, even if it had nothing at all to do with you. And then you kind of carry that, you know, you start getting conditioned, right? If you start doing that kind of, those kind of exercises with yourself at 12 or 13 or 14 or, you know, whatever the age is, you continue that on when you're 20 or 25 or 30, and it just becomes a fabric of who you are.
Yes, 100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like the perfectionism. It's like, okay, I can't control what's going on with my parents, but I can control the fact that I can get 90s at school and I can, you know, be this picture perfect teenager for my parents. So the outside world thinks everything's okay and it's something that I can control.
Right, which is, there's a good, I don't know if I want to call him like a philosopher, he's a former rapper, but his name on, you can find him on Facebook, Prince A, which Prince and then space EA, but there's a great quote that he had in that documentary about Sarno where he said the turning point for him is really instead of trying to change everything around it, maybe consider like changing yourself in order to deal with the world. And I think that's a big part of it too. So, okay, so the people pleasing element of the personality. Okay, so we're probably coming into 2017 at this point, and you had this underlying fear. You had the dots connected for you with Sarno. You know, keep humming on with the story.
Yeah. So, 2017. So, I was, like I said, I was almost to the point where I had it figured out. I remember specifically, I just got in from dinner with my boyfriend and we were lying on the couch. And then all of a sudden I just had this panic overwhelmingly come over me. Like, never had a panic attack like that before in my life. And then the pain came back immediately. And for about 8 months straight, I would have panic attack after panic attack accompanied with the pain. Like, it got to the point where I couldn't walk room to room within my own house without being scared. And at that point, it was more fear of the symptoms. So fear of fear, essentially. And that, like, how am I going to get a hold of this? I know what this is. Why can't I do this? And then I remember being at one of my girlfriend's bachelorette parties, and I forced myself to go, which I am grateful I did. And I was literally on my phone the whole time, like, figuring out how I can deal with this. But it's funny, at the bachelorette party, it went away. My pain went away. I still had the panic, but my pain went away for those 2 days. It was just gone. And then as soon as I drove back into town, it came back. And then I started looking more at fear and reading more into anxiety. And I'm one of these people that I need to kind of logically understand things in a way. Like, I know there's so many, and that was me then. I think now I'm more in tune with my intuition and going on my gut feeling.
Yep.
Then I was very much a logical person. So for me, diving into anxiety and what anxiety does to us, it's tangible for me to understand getting through this. So I forget what the user's name is on the TMS forum, but he was kind of, I think it was on the old TMS forum too. He was the one who talked a lot about how for him, it was changing his relationship with fear that helped alleviate his symptoms. And in my gut, I knew that's what I had to do. So I researched anxiety and started putting all of my symptoms into one category instead of being like, well, if I get rid of the panic, then I'll get rid of my symptoms. If I get rid of the pain, then I'll get rid of my panic. I decided I needed to collectively put it all together and just deal with it as one thing. That was the only way I could get through this.
Which is anxiety.
Yes. For whatever reason, that's just what clicked for me. And I read a book called At Last a Life by Paul David. It's a self-published book. And he basically talks about his anxiety journey and how he had it for 15 years and how he got through it. And I applied his principles to treating my TMS and my panic symptoms. And so for the next, so this would have been July that I went to the bachelorette party.
Of 2017 or 2018.
17. Yeah. And then from about August till December, I started applying these principles, which basically was learning to accept absolutely everything, every sensation, whether it be pain, panic, every emotion, learning to actually like go through emotions instead of logically go through them, actually feel emotions. So what it feels like in your body to feel anger or sadness or guilt or shame. I had to look at my whole TMS symptoms and emotions as part of me, but not all of me. But they were a part that I needed to become acquainted with and comfortable in order for me to get through. And so for about 5 months, it was me just learning how to sit with the pain without judging it, sit with my emotions without judging them, sit with my panic without judging it. My thoughts were horrible at that point. So getting to know like the lizard brain and tricks that it would play on me. And that one thing he said on his blog, Paul David, was everything that you think that has to do with anxiety is anxiety. Speaking,
it,
literally.
Sorry, it cut out. You said everything that has to do with anxiety is or is not?
Is. So, is, yes. So say your thought is like, oh my God, I'm not doing this right. Well, that's anxiety, yeah. Right? So... And I had a lot of those thoughts. I was talking to my counselor and I had a lot of those, like, what if I'm doing this wrong? Well, that's an anxiety thought. That's perpetuating the symptoms,
and
right?
You're just saying, like, I mean, this could be anything, right? It could be how you handled a conversation with a client. It could be the type of thing that you bought at the store. Like, you're saying, like, this was popping up everywhere.
Everywhere. Like, not only was I having to deal with the lizard brain about my TMS symptoms, I started to realize I have to start dealing with these thoughts that and behaviors that led up to these TMS symptoms. Like, in order for me to live a full life, I need to actually start diving into this crappy stuff that I've been avoiding for a very long time. And it was at that point when I realized I knew I was going to get through it, when I could actually start thinking about the actual problems that we're perpetuating the TMS as opposed to just the TMS itself.
Right. You know, that's really interesting because so you and then one other person that I've talked to on this show have spoken about treating anxiety as opposed to treating pain. And the other person was Dr. David Hanscom, who ironically is a spinal surgeon in Seattle. And we met up at the Washington State Athletic Club in July, and he had had chronic pain for years and years and years, back pain, knee pain, all these issues. And he's, you know, he's got, just like everybody, he could take the image, you know, you could take the imaging and you could find problems. But he was on the freeway one night and essentially had the world's worst, you know, a panic attack times 1,000, and it just completely shut him down. Like literally stopped the car, have a freak out, like total panic attack. And he said when he treated the anxiety, it completely changed how he viewed everything. Like this is a guy who went to medical school, became a surgeon operating on people's spines, who's saying that spine surgery does not correct chronic pain at all and to treat it as anxiety. And like you're saying exactly the same kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like once you know, there is no other way of looking at it. Like it's such a truth that it's unavoidable once you actually know it.
What about, so one thing that you said that I have a lot of interest in, because I think it's like, I feel like it's pretty vague to a lot of people. And so they don't necessarily know how, and I mean, when people ask me, I'm not sure I even know how to really explain it. Although I did read a really good blog last night, ironically, about how to feel emotions for people with pelvic pain, because I see a lot of women talking about pelvic pain. I've interviewed a woman on this show who talked a lot about pelvic pain, and it was something that she was able to get alleviated through this kind of work. But I guess talk us through the feeling of emotions. You spent that 4 or 5 months from August through December, August through January, really like learning how to just sit with it, accept it, and feel it. How could you best describe how somebody could feel their emotions?
Yeah, so I think in our society, especially Western societies, we're trained to describe emotions logically, whereas emotions aren't really a logical thing. You have to, first of all, become comfortable with just being in your body. So the first thing I started to do was just feel like what my hands felt like when they weren't grabbing onto anything, like feel the buzz in your body, feel what it's like to actually be sitting on a chair. So doing little things like that throughout the day, just to get accustomed to actually being within our body instead of being totally up in our heads. But in a detached way. That's the thing with TMS, is that we get so attached to that sensation of pain. You have to start almost looking at it as just like a layer in your body as opposed to what your body is. So at first I got comfortable with just feeling different sensations in my body. And then when an emotion would come up, typically our emotions are felt within our torso. So I would directly feel into my torso and start describing it. So right now, because of personal circumstances, I feel in my solar plexus area a lot of almost like squirmy kind of jello-y feeling, and I can feel it kind of streaming into my chest. So really descriptive words. And kind of just really lean into that feeling, like be very mindful of what that feels like. So then when you actually do go through something that evokes a really strong emotion and sensation in your body, you're able to be with that and let it discharge. So you don't keep that within your nervous system.
Because, so what you're just, and what you're describing, was that like, in Paul David's book, is he like giving instruction on how to do this? Is this where you pick this up?
I picked it up actually. There's a work, Dr. Peter Levine.
Yep.
So he works with the somatic therapy. And he basically describes exactly what you're supposed to do. So
you stole my thunder. I was going to go there. It's actually, I wasn't going to say Peter Levine, though he is the expert in the field, but you mentioned the Pain Psychology Center earlier, and Alan Gordon has a whole, on his
I think he calls it the SEP, like the Structural Educational Program. But he does a section on somatic tracking, and I find it so interesting because on the outside looking in, and if you were to tell somebody that doesn't know anything about Sarno's work, you would probably say that this is all baloney, because if I'm just describing what I'm feeling in my body and being mindful of the sensation, like, what is that going to do, right? But like, now to us, it seems absurd to think otherwise.
Yeah.
I think that stuff is, I think it's super interesting. And Peter Levine is the absolute, I think that he's the basically the gospel god of this kind of stuff. So,
yeah. And I guess the best way, like in a layman's term, and I might be getting this wrong, but for this is just how I look at it. It's building that resilience within your nervous system. So it's just like anything, the more you practice it, the easier it gets, and then the more calm you feel, right? So when you're learning something new, you're always kind of nervous about it.
Yep.
And that's the same thing with learning your emotions. So at first they might feel overwhelming, it might feel strange, but then eventually over time, becoming attuned to what they feel like calms your nervous system down, because it doesn't view them as a threat anymore. It doesn't view them as something that you don't know.
Well, and by doing that, I mean, by you doing tracking and actually like addressing it and leaning into it, like you had said, it's the absolute opposite of repression, and repression is what causes this stuff. And you also had 27 years of conditioning to do it one way. So the fact that it would have taken 4 or 5 months to unwind that, to me, almost seems fast, right?
It is. I mean, I'm working on it, though. It's not something I've given up. I work on it every day, and there's days where it still is overwhelming. There's days, well, I told you about what has happened to me recently, and to be honest, if I didn't go through TMS and learn how to have emotional resilience, I have no idea where I would be right now. Like, it is a tool I think that every human being should know in order to be able to deal with what life throws you. Like, we really need to start actually feeling our feelings, no matter how shitty they feel.
And the feeling of the feelings part, because like, again, like the vagueness of it, I think the somatic tracking is so powerful because it actually helps. I think it just helps you put an identifier or make it visual. So many people are these like visual learners, and I'm one of them, like being able to see something and demonstrate it before you do it. And I think you do make a great point that the first time you do anything, or the first time you do, not even the first time, for the first few times, like when I started learning how to ride a motorcycle, first few times I got on that bike, like probably the first month, probably the first 30 times that I did it, like there definitely is a level of nervousness. And now I've been riding for this would be my 9th year, and now it, you know, it ain't no thing, right? I just jump on the bike and I just go. And that's probably how somatic tracking is for you. So to segue, cause you sort of alluded to it a second ago, but you had mentioned talking about, things that have gone on recently. And if you didn't have these kind of tools that, you know, the kind of what's been going on with you the last 6 months could have been completely different. And so do you feel comfortable going into that?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's something that people need to talk about more. So my boyfriend, who I've talked about, that when I first met, when I was about 22, when everything kind of started happening. So we got married at the end of the summer, and he actually passed away a week later in an accident, obviously very unexpectedly. And grief is, especially grief like that, I mean, I lost my grandparents and that was hard, but this is a whole other level. And I am so grateful that I went through anxiety and TMS, because I would have been an absolute disaster. Like, I was still a disaster, but I mean, like, I would have been so completely even more lost had I not had those tools to help myself through this time, which I'm still going through. Obviously, I'll be going through this for probably the rest of my life to some degree. But when Evan first passed away, I had all those pains come back, and I knew they would come back. because it's so overwhelming to deal with that degree of grief. I mean, to lose your husband at 30 and a week after you get married is in such a tragic way is just unbelievable to begin with, and have it happen to you is hard to wrap your brain around. And I had so many emotions that came up that felt so overwhelming. I can't even imagine how they would have felt if I didn't do this work previously. And I was able to actually, within those emotions and feeling so devastated, be able to tap into my intuition, which is something that actually, if you do this work with emotions, you start to open up your intuition more. And I was able to actually tap into my intuition and ask what I needed to get through this. And it was self-love. That's what came back. Self-love. And the pain came back, like I said, and the anxiety and the panic came back. But I knew that it wouldn't last forever. I didn't go down that fear of this is going to be my life with this pain. It was a new fear now of the unknown, because everything I had known for the past 7 years we had been together disappeared so quickly. So it helped me through because I was actually able to embrace my grief as opposed to push it away, which a lot of people do because our society is so uncomfortable with grief. And I don't blame people. I mean, what do you say to somebody who just lost their husband at 30, or anybody really, when they lose somebody or get diagnosed with cancer or anything? It's so hard. And being able to know my boundaries with certain people and know what I wanted and know what I needed because of this work I had done with TMS, it was life-saving to me. Absolutely life-saving.
Thank you so much for being willing to share that. I was, when you had said it, when I first called you, I started scrolling your Instagram and was trying to piece together the timeline. Cause right, you know, like I see the wedding pictures, right? And then something happened, right? So I guess talk about, like, you mentioned, like, the anxiety comes back, the pain comes back, and like, you know, grief is a thing that just a lot of us can't, we just don't have the capacity to deal with. It's just something that we almost like shun away and we repress. And that's, you know, that's the root of a lot of the problems. So is it something where you talked about feeling a lot of these feelings in your trunk, is what you had mentioned earlier, like solar plexus and into the chest and all that kind of stuff. Like, maybe it was, maybe the feeling and the tracking you were doing a year and a half was, that's a feeling of sadness versus this is a feeling of grief, which are, they're similar, but they are two different things. Is that, like, you know, kind of run us through a little bit more about A, it did come back, two, where were you feeling those types of pains? And then how long did, I know you had said you're going to be dealing with it certainly for a long, long time. But when I say the worst of the feeling, meaning the worst of the pain, like, how long did that take to really get over since you had the tools?
Yeah. So the pain itself, so the emotional pain, the worst of it, was probably the first 3 months. Like, I literally felt like my soul was ripped out of me. It's hard to even describe. Very overwhelming. And then the back pain and the pelvic pain came back intermittently. I would say because I was able to just leave it and knew that it was there to protect me in a way. The pain was there to distract me from what I was going through and the feelings I was having losing Evan. I was okay in a way with them being there because it was annoying. It was, I'm not going to lie. Oh my God, I have to deal with this pain on top of this grief now. But just being able to just like know that it was there for a reason to protect me, regardless of how annoyed I was with it. So it probably would have only lasted about a week at a time at the most, but then it would come back intermittently. So every time I would go into like a huge, deep wave of grief, the pain would kind of come back a little bit. But now, so this has been about 5.5 months since the accident. I don't really get the pain anymore. I just get the grief come in waves. I get some sensations. I think a lot of people with TMS believe that we should never have TMS sensations once we're healed, but that's untrue. We're human beings. I mean, our nervous systems are there to protect us, so we're always going to have TMS symptoms. And I just had to acknowledge that it wasn't this evil thing like I first thought it was. It was really there to protect me, help distract me from all the grief I was going through with Evan. So,
certainly. Now I'm envisioning these like tracking sessions as almost being like meditation sessions, or is it not? Is it not quite that? I mean, maybe
it can be. I mean, okay. It depends. Like sometimes it is meditation, like especially when you're practicing. Like if I'm lying in bed and I'm having a really bad day, I go into my body and it does become more of a meditation. When I'm just kind of out and about and I'm doing it, it's more of like, I guess it's connected. It's more being mindful. It's being mindful and aware of where you are in the present moment. So if I'm out with friends and they're having a great time and I'm feeling really down because of everything that's happened, I don't necessarily need to run out of the room or blame them for having a good time when I'm feeling so crappy. I just kind of go into myself and into my body and allow myself to feel like that for that time being. And then usually if I actually allow myself and be mindful and kind of meditative, like you said, maybe it's a quick like minute meditation, if you want to call it that, of the sensations in your body, and just now I don't even need to label them or like necessarily describe the sensation. I can just really just feel, lean into it. It usually passes a lot quicker and I'm able to become more present with my friends.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and that's something I want to talk about too, because I think about you described like the bachelorette party that happened in 2017, and it was 2 days of like, you know, there's no pain, you have your life completely back. And I remember like in between the time of me discovering Sarno for the first time, and I mean even to now, I would say like the bulk of my symptoms left, I mean, and were completely gone, I don't know, 2 months ago, but I do still have like, you know, for every 15 days that are great, there might be 8 hours or 12 hours that like, what is up with my back? And yesterday, I remember I was feeling something like that. I did some tracking exercise. And I mean, literally, we're talking 30 seconds to a minute. And it was, you know, it dissolved pretty fast. But, you know, part of me wonders, like, you're at this bachelorette party, and the pain disappears for a couple of days. And like, all these friends that were probably, you know, came to you and were very supportive after Evan had passed away, like I mean, did they understand like the magnitude of everything that you had kind of gone through from a pain and anxiety perspective before? Like is everybody in your circle, like, are they aware that you had all these problems prior that you were able to get rid of, and that a relapse is likely going to happen because of all these new circumstances? Like was that ever a part of the conversation with your inner circle?
Not really. I think they knew that it was a horrible time for me, but they didn't. I don't think you really know the extent of it unless you're actually like experiencing it. Yeah. You know, like, I feel like the word anxiety and chronic pain, unfortunately, is thrown around in our society like it ain't no thing. And people become desensitized to how much it affects somebody until they go through something similar. But I must say that my closest group of friends have been incredibly supportive since Evan's accident. And they obviously knew it was going to be very hard for me. They didn't really talk about the pain. But they knew that they could relate more to the anxiety than the pain, I think. So that's why they talked more about the anxiety, like making sure that they're checking in on me and that I don't shut myself in too much and whatnot. Just making sure that I'm getting out and about and just doing their best just to be there and be supportive and understand my journey as much as they can. And But Evan's mom, she knew more, I think, about, and my parents as well, but she knew quite a bit. She knew how severe the pain was because Evan would go there and be quite upset that he couldn't help me and whatever. And so I had mentioned to her that I was worried that the pain was going to come back quite a bit. And, but she was great and just saying, you know, you've had it before. And if it comes back, you know what to do. And it's true. It's just like having that person there to support you. I think that's huge. My friends, like I said, they weren't, the connection with the pain wasn't there as much, but I looked at it, their support for me going through losing my husband definitely helped make everything easier, which in turn helped me probably lessen the severity of the relapse with this going on.
Do you find yourself, you had mentioned like your friends were making essentially a cognizant effort to make sure, quote unquote, that that you were like getting out. Do you find yourself having to be like making an effort's maybe not the right thing, but actually being like a lot of times today's a great example for me actually, because I'm just thinking, God, like the last like 3-4 days have just kind of been not terrible, but just like, God, it's Friday and I really would just love to lay on the couch and veg out on like some ice cream or something. But my wife and I are going to an engagement tonight. And so I'm like, you've got to go out and like see some people because like, it, yeah. You know, you work from home and you need to go out and get some social interaction. Like, do you find yourself doing that as well? Like saying like, I don't really feel like it. However, I know that in the long run, like, you know, human connection ultimately is a lot of what a lot of us, you know, all of us really want. And I think maybe in a way that's a big contributing factor to people getting something like this is not feeling connected at all different levels. Like, do you find yourself almost like pushing and saying, Michelle, like go, you know, go do something right now?
It's actually ironic in a way that I feel more connected to people now than I did before Evan passed away. Like, because he was my everything. He was my best friend. He was my rock. He was my mentor. And it's easy to kind of let friendships go when you have that person. And not saying we like only hung out together. We did a lot with other people. But I'm more consciously making an effort of being with people and just actually enjoying friendships. Yeah. But in the first few months, especially the first weeks after his accident, I had to force myself like out of bed. I knew I had to, even if it was just to have a shower, put on clean clothes, and I could crawl back into bed.
Yeah.
I remember going through TMS when I was in my really, really crappy part, deep hole TMS. Evan would, like, if it was 11 o'clock in the morning, Evan would open the blinds and take off the covers and be like, look, we're getting you up, you're having a shower, you're getting dressed, you're eating. And if that's all you do, that's all you do. So it's those baby steps. I know that a lot of people suffer from depression with TMS, and also depression is a TMS symptom. As much as you feel like you don't want to, like, the ability to even get out of bed is something to be proud about. And then to connect with other people, it is so important. And not just on social media. I think social media is such a false way to connect with people. You need to connect with people in person, or at least on the phone at the very least. But being with people and being with other energy is very healing. Like, at least uplifting energy. You don't necessarily want to be with somebody who's going to scare you into an even deeper hole, but which happened quite a bit actually when Evan passed away. His mother and I had to be very mindful of the people that we let around us, and most people were really good, but a lot of people do have that negativity bias, and it's just being mindful of what energy you want around you and knowing no matter how crappy you feel and no matter where you are in that moment, it's okay to be where you are. But allowing yourself to connect with other people who have good energy and want only the best for you is so healing, like so, so, so healing. When I was going through TMS, there would be times where I would force myself to go to dinner with friends and I'd be so anxious and I'd be in pain, but it was something that I could look back and be like, you know what? I did that. At least I did that.
Yeah, no, I get that. I understand that for sure. There's Steve Ozanich, I feel like in his books, to me, and he's talked a little bit more about this since the books came out, but I really feel like the underlying tone in a lot of what he writes about is like human connection and going out and seeing people. Like pretty much like right after I read Sarno's book, I sort of caught on to that. And I remember I would make it a thing where, because my life for several years became just, especially after I had our first kid, go to work, you know, nose to the grindstone, do what you have to do. And then, you know, go home, work out. And a lot of times I like work out by myself and then go pick up my kid and then make her dinner, put her to bed. Like there wasn't like a lot of course I have the connection of like my kids and my wife and stuff like that, but there is a world outside of that and not feeling like that is there. And pretty close, I mean, within, I don't know, 2-3 weeks of reading Sarno, I remember telling my wife, like, I am going to go and have coffee with somebody that doesn't live in this house like once a week. You know what I mean? Just going to do something. And I feel like that's a big, I mean, when I get 2 or 3 days, cause I work remotely, I work from home. And so when I get 2 or 3 days of like not leaving the house for anything except going to pick my kids up, like I start getting really antsy. Like I rejoined a CrossFit gym because of the open style of, you know, you have 20 other people that are around you and you're here doing this common thing. Like I looked at it as an investment in health because and not just like the investment in health of like cardiovascular and strength and all that stuff, but like the mental side of it, having a connection with other human beings that don't live in your house, I feel like is a big thing.
Yeah. And I think that people I'm reading, I don't know if have you ever read anything by Brené Brown?
No.
She's wonderful. She talks about vulnerability and shame, essentially. That her big work is about shame. And I think shame is huge with TMS. It is so huge in our society. And she just talks about how we're so scared of being vulnerable with people and being our true selves. Because of shame, we're shamed from when we're young, we're shamed by social media, that we often avoid situations that make us feel vulnerable, which often includes what you're talking about, you know, joining a gym where you might not be the best person in the room, but who cares? You're there to make connections with people, you know, like going out with friends, even though maybe they did something more exciting than you and you feel that shame monster going in, but it's like, I don't know. It's hard to describe. It's just, people need to realize that there's so much more to life than just this like little fishhole that we think we have. And that being vulnerable and open to connection and human connection and love and belonging is ultimately so what life is about, I think. And that if you can open yourself up to be a little bit more vulnerable with people, your life will improve. And for people who have mind-body syndrome, that will improve.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when you say like having situations where you look around and this person is better than me in some way. In 2016, when my symptoms really started amping up, I remember if you would have asked me then, I would have said, no, that doesn't exist. I'm not feeling that way. But there was a time, a good 2-3 year period in my career where I was making, to me, like money hand over fist. Like I was doing so well in sales and I was this absolute star. And then I had like just a bum, just a down year, like any athlete could have, you know, like any team could have, like any person can have, like, because we can all have like great years and then a year that's not so great. And I kind of felt that way about my career. And looking back, I know that I was easily looking around and seeing all these other salespeople that not only are making a lot more than me, but are also more quote unquote successful than me because they're making more. Right. And, me being able to say that now, it, you know, that, that took a long time to be able to, you know, say out loud, like there's shame and there's guilt that's involved there. I looked up, I definitely heard the name wrong because I Amazoned it and she doesn't exist. Did you say, you didn't say Brenna Brown. Who's the author?
No, Brené. So it's B-R-E-N-E and it's got like an accent on the last E. Gotcha. And Brown.
Okay, perfect. I posted on a I posted on somebody's Facebook this morning, or I commented on this post that she did where there was a lot of it was just a very like she was talking about a lot of vulnerable stuff. She's got it was about like New Year's resolutions and she's having a second kid that's coming soon and just talking about the change that's involved in life and you know that typically I'll start out a new year where I'm going to eat better and I'm going to work out more and I'm going to be in better shape and I'm going to do all this. She's like, I'm not really doing any of that because I'm unsure about this and I'm unsure about that and I don't know how this is going to go. And I was just thinking like, gosh, like, you know, vulnerability is such like an attractive trait, whether you're male or female, but just the ability to say that like, you know, I feel this way or I to be able to integrate that. I interviewed Dr. Arlene Feinblatt and Dr. Eric Sherman, who were both like referring psychologists of Dr. Sarno in his heyday. And that episode aired a couple of days ago as you and I record this. But they'd said one of the most critical things for people in like the necessity that people need to be able to get over this is developing a vocabulary for feelings. Because if you can't ever like if you get stuck in this, I think this, I think that, like that's sort of the wrong place. And I think what they were implying, at least the way that I interpreted it, is that a lot of therapy and a lot of people's introspective work is simply just developing a vocabulary to say that I feel a certain way. I mean, I remember my almost five-year-old and I, we were at Costco the other day and she had said something to me. She just kind of looked bothered. And I asked her, you know, what's up? And she just said, I feel sad. And I was like, what a gift for a four-year-old to be able to just, you know, feel that and say that. And because like what, you know, what teenagers or 20-year-olds or 30-year-olds or 40-year-olds have the ability to stop and say, I feel this way without being prompted. It doesn't exist.
And it's so funny how like Brené Brown, she's so much better at explaining this than me, obviously. She talks about how we often, like you said, what a great quality to have for somebody to be vulnerable, but we often don't want ourselves to be vulnerable or won't allow ourselves to be vulnerable because we view it as a weakness because we're sharing our weaknesses in a sense. We're sharing what makes us less than perfect or what society thinks is perfect. Yep. But everybody has vulnerabilities. Nobody's perfect. And I think with me being more vulnerable about my grief on social media, I felt like it was an outlet that I needed to share because how crazy it is how people handle grief. I felt like I needed to share what I was going through with people to a degree. There's some stuff I obviously keep private, but or only share with very, very close people. But I think in order to really have true human connection, the ability to vocalize how we feel in a safe way, by admitting, you know, I'm imperfect, people realize that they're just like you. So you become more safe to them in a way. And then you can develop better connections with those people. Like, it's incredible the amount of people who I don't even know that message me or come up to me and say I've been so inspiring and have helped them through things, which is I'm so grateful for because that's I want to share what I've gone through with TMS and with my grief to help other people to know, you know what? We all go through these thoughts. We all have similar things. We all have feelings of sadness and anger and situations that make us feel vulnerable. And that's okay. And that's okay to talk about. And that's okay to share. And that's okay to vocalize. Like, You don't need to feel ashamed because you're a freaking human being. Yep. Like, that's what being human is all about.
As we're wrapping up, I guess maybe the last thing that I would want to ask you about is, I guess, rewind yourself, which it's tough to do. A lot's happened. But rewind yourself to like 2015. Yeah, 2015. Let's say like pre, because you said the pain got super bad in 2016. So let's like go before that. I guess just, you know, in that 4 years, what has changed for you in terms of, you know, your thoughts and your feelings and sort of how you treat yourself and your daily, we don't even have to call it a practice, but almost like a, you know, a moment to moment, how you're living your life, how you're thinking about things, how you're taking the wins and the losses. Talk a little bit about that as we wrap up.
Yeah. And I think when people talk about how grateful they are for TMS, being able to vocalize this is what it's kind of all about. Even though I lost my husband, I'm still so grateful. So back then, I didn't really think about things I was grateful for. So that's changed. I'm grateful every day for even small things. Neighbors shoveling my driveway right now, which is wonderful. I was so scared of taking responsibility for myself then. So responsibility for emotions that felt scary. I'm able now to apologize if I feel I have said something that might have upset somebody or whatnot. But at the same time, I'm able to put up boundaries. So with clients, before I would always say yes and never say no. So I worked myself to the bone. So now I'm able to say, you know what? I know I'm good with this amount of clients a day. That's what I'm going to stick to. Sorry, I can't get you in. That's changed. I'm more mindful of just every day being outside nature. I can actually take in, you know, the beauty that's around me in a more profound way. I feel more grounded. I feel more connected to my family, to my friends. I don't take life for granted. I don't just chase money and chase success in a monetary way. I look at success as the ability to love myself and others more. And just, I guess I have a mindset of growth. I want to grow. I want to constantly be growing and being better for myself, which in turn makes me a better person for other people. Yeah. So that's what TMS and my struggles with TMS has taught me. Like, I was lucky and I'm grateful to come out on the other side of TMS, because I know there's people who have been stuck in it for a very long time, knowing what it is. And I've been there, and it's a very scary feeling. But when, and you will get through it, when that happens, life is so much better on the other side.
I couldn't agree more. And it's, you know, it's tough. It's that whole, like, not being able to see the forest through the trees thing. I think that we're also blinded. It reminded me the other day, I shared something on, and it was kind of like it's actually the post that you had responded to, but I put the same thing on my Facebook account where I had talked about how, you know, it's not your flat feet, it's not your this, it's not your that. Like, this comes from emotional repression, change my mind, basically. And like the amount of like visceral hatred that came from people. I mean, even my brother had just said, you know, it's not, you know, herniated discs and all this kind of stuff. And I like, a couple people had said, oh, well, so I just think happy thoughts and pain will go away. And then, you know, they're calling me Peter Pan and all this kind of stuff. And I mean, not coincidentally, my back starts, you know, I start getting that feeling again, early the next morning. And, you know, again, a minute of somatic tracking took that away. But, I hear you. And I think that for the people that were commenting on stuff like that and saying that it doesn't exist and it's not a real thing and it has to do with all this other stuff, like I definitely feel like I'm better afterwards. Again, like just being able to share, again, like little things like sharing that moment with my 4-year-old in a grocery store where I ask her what she's feeling, and she says she's feeling sad. And then I told her I was feeling sad, and then she's crying, and we're hugging it out. Like nothing happened. You know what I mean? It's just that it's just the way that it is. And I think that comes back to what you had said earlier, which is, you know, withholding the judgment on the feeling or not even needing to necessarily know why it exists or why it's there. It's just, it is what it is.
Yeah. And then how beautiful of a moment to share with your daughter, like an everyday, somebody who's not mindful of that would just be whatever. But for you, it's such a like connecting moment with her. And that's so wonderful.
Yeah. Michelle, thank you so much. I kept you longer than I promised, but I sure enjoyed this. This has definitely been one of my favorites. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, and good luck. And thank you for spreading the word.